Thank you very much, Professor Lasker. And would you like to entertain some questions?
If they're entertaining, I'll entertain.
The floor is open, so please.
Maybe.
Is there a question?
What is this concept of God? Is the intuitive or the naive concept is very abstract philosophical one. Is it possible that you also redefine love in a way that is not our intuitive idea and then things fit together more?
Well, okay, the question is about what's our intuitive idea of love, and I'm presumably one's intuitive idea of love of God is different than our intuitive idea of love, human love. And I think Maimonides is trying to say that, but he's saying that some of the phenomena of this love of God are parallel to the phenomena, the human aspects of love. I think also when you're saying the love, the way he uses the term love is in a sense an ambiguous term or an equivocal term, namely one that means something different on the human plane than it does on the divine plane. So it's certainly when he's saying that people should love God, he's not talking the same language, he's using the same words, but not the same meaning as when he's talking about human love.
Are you suggesting that God means to mislead most people by asking that people love God and do all the mitzvah while he or she knows that is not achievable?
Okay, the question is God's misleading people. The Arabs have a good word for it. It's called luft or talaftuf, which means in Shlomo Pinus' translation, wily graciousness. And Maimonides says, indeed, that God exercises this type of wily graciousness. His example is that when God took the children of Israel out of Egypt, he did not lead him on the way of the sea, the Via Maris, which would get them from Goshen to Gaza in 10 easy days. He realized if they'd gone to Gaza first, they probably would have turned around and left and disengaged. But therefore, God took them 40 years in the desert to get them ready for the entrance into the land and to get them away from slavery into freedom. In like manner, God gives commandments which are not intrinsically valuable in themselves. He, she, it promises reward and punishment on a very mass level for the non-elite. And the few who are able to understand the reasons behind the commandments will then get up to will overcome their childish view of God to a more sophisticated view of God. I know that a number of my students, especially those from more traditional fundamentalist religious backgrounds, are very upset by this view, Maimonides' view. And I try to say to them, but look, let's take God's corporeality. The Bible uses corporeal terms. Of course, they say right away, but it doesn't mean that. And I said, well, maybe it does mean it, but it's meant in a different manner, and that actually, if you take God as a body, you're being childish. Well, they agree to that. So I said, perhaps if you think that God will actually reward and punish every commandment you observe or sin you do, maybe that's also childish. And that they're not willing to buy. But I think that is one of the lessons of the guide, which angered the 10,000 people and made only one person happy, presumably, as he says in the introduction.
I have another question. If I understand what you're saying, and what Maimonides is trying to tell us is that the search for perfection involves searching at whatever one's capability is more and more to understand and to love God. Maimonides was a healer. He was a healer of other people. What I gathered from what you said, and I'm really surprised at that, is that he said, you don't have to worry about healing other people, except as it helps you reach God, but you never mentioned healing others at all. And then what did he say about our responsibility to others other than doing this through the search for God?
Okay. For those here who know the literature know that I've been alluding to a debate that occurred between two of my teachers, both very close to their death, was Professor Shlomo Pinas of the Hebrew University and my doctoral mentor, Professor Alexander Altman of Brandeis University, about the question of the achievability of metaphysical knowledge and the perfection of human perfection. Now, if there are two different trends in the guide, two very strong different trends in the guide. One is the go off on your own, escape to the mountains, give lectures, public lectures on a Sunday afternoon while you're totally ignoring the people sitting there and not thinking about them at all, but rather contemplating God. That one can achieve a certain amount of intellectual perfection and one can therefore reach one's own personal perfection. The other trend is that this is impossible. And therefore, the most that one can do is be involved in society, that the perfection, human perfection, means being a good leader of a society, whether as a prophet or after the age of prophecy as a leader, imitating God's actions, attributes of actions, judging the society fairly, exactly as people deserve and not on whim, etc. So Maimonides in his own life, in a sense, combined the two. He was a healer. I don't know. I mean, he was a doctor. From what we now know, he didn't do very much healing. But he did. He was a doctor. He was a community leader. He was a person extremely involved in the society. He was a person who got up early in the morning to go to work and then came home in the afternoon to do his night job in the community and stayed up till all hours of the night. He's a man who says have three good meals a day, who himself had one meal a day. He's a man who said that the bad things happen to you if you pursue things you don't need or don't take care of yourself, which is exactly what he himself did. So there are a lot of contradictions in his own life. For those of you familiar with Plato's Republic, know that the person who escapes from the cave has exactly the same problem. Should he stay outside the cave and know the truth and leave behind all the people in the cave, or should he go back to the cave and try to draw them into the truth and teach them what's really out there? And of course, the ideal leader for Plato goes back into the cave, but it's not a very pleasant experience because no one wants to hear what the real truth is. So Maimonides had these two aspects of his life, and he was able to combine them. The generations that came after him were basically divided between philosophers who were interested in themselves and legalists who were interested in the community, and we never again had a person like Maimonides who was able to combine the two together in that manner. Maybe I should let the person with the microphone decide. Hey, Chris. Professor Hayes.
Would you perhaps comment on the very last section of the guide 354, which really addresses this conversation? Because although 351 has a utilitarian view of the commandments, like it simply help you obtain the perfection that you need in order to really do the important stuff, which is philosophy and contemplation. But in 54, he does seem to say the whole goal and point of contemplation is that you finally perceive God as he is, and you see his attributes, which are justice, mercy, and loving kindness, and that catapults you into this imitatio Dei, so that ultimately the end of study is that it leads you to acts of justice, mercy, and loving kindness in the world. So doesn't that sort of address...
Well, it does address the problem. Of course, it doesn't solve the problem because Maimonides never solves the problem. So you have two choices. One is that after 170-some-odd chapters, the guide in which he's pushing toward intellectual perfection, when he gets to the very end, what is the bottom line of intellectual perfection is societal involvement. And so there you say, okay, we've solved the problem, that intellectual perfection means societal involvement. What we don't know is, A, is this some sort of sop to the unaware reader who skipped from chapter 1 or 2 to see who did it at the end? All right, skip to the last chapter. Is this some sort of hidden code? Is it telling us that, indeed, there is no intellectual knowledge of God, the only thing we can do is the political thing? In which case, would fit into what I said about the problem of love of God. There's no intellectual knowledge of God. There's no love of God. And indeed, the bottom line is go out and be a good person and lead society and imitate God in that manner. The problem is when we have a commandment to imitate God, in order to imitate God, we have to know something about what God does in order to imitate what God is. And we don't know what God is. We can't know what God is. The most we can do is note perhaps what God does. And perhaps that's the imitation. So all, indeed, the last chapter of the guide puts all these trends together and leads the suspicious reader with as many questions as she began at the beginning of the book.
Are you equating his notion of doing justice and mercy and loving kindness with his description of the life of the commandments? Because I don't think they're the same
thing. No, not the life of the commandments, the life of the commander in a sense, small c. In fact, Maimonides there in 354 explicitly refers to what he said in 154. And if one wants to be a numerologist, one can start asking questions about that. But indeed, where in 154 Moses is described as being the most perfect human because of his societal involvement and because of his leadership. In other words, Moses did acts of loving kindness and justice in the world because he was imitating God, because that's all we can do. After he's been outside the cave. So that's one trend. But 354 and 39 and 1-2 one could throw these lines out, these chapters out without end, seem to say a different thing. So if you want to take the view that, indeed, the last chapter is the bottom line, so then the bottom line is what you should do is pursue an act, a life of activity, political activity, run for office, do a good job running the community and the state, and that way you're imitating God. Dare say some political leaders think they're imitating God, but... I don't know if in my Maimonidean sense.
Thank you. I'd like to ask specifically both what you think Maimonides would say and what you think yourself about the relationship between the study of physics and metaphysics and then that highest stage of the ascent, which you describe as the passion and love of God. So you're building ascent, and I'm glad you mentioned Plato because it's in many ways mirrors the kind of ascent that he talks about. Started with commandments, just actions, and attempting to do that. You sort of move up to studies, forms in that case. And then at the highest state, there's this sort of unity of form, the form which I take to be God, which causes everything, as Plato describes it. So I think in reading Maimonides and reading Plato and reading the other people in the tradition between and after, one always wonders, what am I getting by studying physics and metaphysics that's going to get me to this next stage? That's question one. Now, question number two is, do you have to do it at all? I mean, can you bypass that? And here's the reason I ask that. As I've thought more and more about it, it seems that one of the things you learn in doing metaphysics, and I think you've said it several times in your talk, is you learn that there's no answer. You learn that we can't know the answer to these important questions. What is God? What are God's actions? We can't account for them perfectly. So is there a way also, I mean, you know, we don't have testimonies of Moses in the laboratory and so forth, so maybe he got up there in ways that sort of got this knowledge of unknowing in a way that didn't involve the intensive study of physics and metaphysics that Maimonides talks about. Maybe that could answer some of the other worries that people have. Thank you.
I hope no one's worried here. One of the debates among the medievals, and one of the things that separated the rationalists with the non-rationalists and sometimes anti-rationalists, is can one achieve true knowledge, true metaphysical knowledge without study? In other words, can one come to class one day and go out the next day with a degree, all right, and with a knowledge? And the Aristotelians deny that. For the Aristotelians, knowledge is a cumulative building up of bringing one's intellect into actuality. And in fact, Maimonides gives a good example, I believe it takes from Galen, we've heard about today, that the person who thinks he learns something from prophecy, that there are people who think they learn something new from prophecy. It says like you're in a house with 1,000 people and suddenly everyone leaves except for one person. And suddenly you see that one person and say, oh, he just came in. The answer is no. He was there already, but you've been through the prophetic process. You've isolated that one fact that you already knew. So Maimonides would say, yes, you have to do the hard work. And he says very explicitly in part 1, chapters 31 through 35, that most people aren't willing to do it, that if you offered them knowledge, as we say in the Jewish tradition, on one leg or one foot, people would be very happy to take it. But if you tell them, all right, you're going to sit here for 50 years, and the end of the process, maybe we'll give you a bachelor's degree, but maybe not, etc. Most people would say, we don't need it, thank you very much. I'll go to a different institution. The University of Latvia is a popular one in Israel. So there is, for Maimonides, there are no shortcuts. And those people looking for shortcuts are because of intellectual weakness, because they're busy, because they have families, because they have physical needs, because their temperament or their matter, they were born, we'd say, with the wrong genes, where nurture prevents them from getting to the knowledge. But there is no shortcut. Now, what happens after you've done all the hard work? Now, I'm sure this is not true of Yale students, but some of the students at my university will occasionally come after getting a grade which is less than they wanted, and saying, but I invested so much in the course. And now I'm always willing to say, well, you know, try the stock market. But, all right, they've invested so much in the course, they deserve to get a good grade. And for Maimonides, you can invest and invest and invest and invest, and sometimes the shares go down and there's nothing you can do about it. There's no guarantee. This is one of the things that Maimonides is pointing out. There's no guarantee that you'll actually get there. I think Rafsanjan Gaon in the 10th century was much more optimistic that if you follow the correct method, you'll get to the truth. But Maimonides says, no, there is a method, you use it, you attempt it, and it's going to stop someplace. Another example from the same chapters I mentioned at the beginning of the book, where he says some people can see a short distance, some people can see a long distance. So I take off my glasses, I can't, even if I squint, and if I squint enough, I'll hurt my eyes, because I'm trying to do something I can't do. Some people can pick up 2 kilos, some people can pick up 20 kilos, some people can pick up 200 kilos. No one, I assume, maybe 2,000 kilos, certainly not 20,000 kilos. No one can pick that up. And if someone tries to do it, all he'll do is hurt himself. So there is, it's a process, it takes a long time, one has to use the correct method, and there are no promises in the world. I think that's what Maimonides is saying. But if you learn enough, it won't bother you when you get to the end of the process and say, well, I didn't get there. But of course, to get there, you have to have learned enough to know that you can't get there. I mean, I don't know if that answers your concerns. But
my real interest is, what's the
what do you get out of it?
What? Sorry, my question was too long-windedly presented. The real crux is there's a point between the top level of the ascent which he described. That is passionate love of God. And that's where the commandments go without concern for reward and so forth. But then underneath that is these years of hard work. So my question, and I think what everybody's question is that what's the relationship between doing all the hard work and then having this super rational thing of the passionate love of God?
I think it's cumulative. I mean, I guess I could say when I get there, I'll let you know. But it seems to me that there is a certain amount of havrakah, lightning. Maimonides, in fact, uses introduction, the example of certain people are on, the humanity is like at night during a storm, right? Maybe Ivan or some other storm, all right? That certain people get one lightning, what does lightning do?
Bolt.
One lightning bolt, thank you, for the whole night, and that's it. And other people have so much lightning, or in the eye of the storm, so much that they see the whole night is illuminated the whole night. Okay, so it's some people get, and when they've gone to that point, then they know, because the light is illuminated, it's light out. All right, when the first thing the person who escaped from the cave did, what is he squints, right? He can't take the light. And slowly, slowly, slowly open until he realizes that his eyes are fully open and he's seeing what there is. And when you get there, presumably you'll know it. I was told one more question, so.
You alluded a couple of times to the issue of gender. And I'm wondering if you can just say a little bit more about the possibility that the mind gives, or whether it gives an equal possibility to women and men to achieve human perfection.
Okay. Maimonides was a product of his time, as we heard this morning. equal opportunity, educational opportunities for women is something which is in the modern period. There are those who accuse Maimonides of decorporalizing, debodifying the Jewish experience, the Jewish people, and therefore entering gender considerations and making males and females and things like that. However, there are enough passages in which it's obvious, such as the case of Miriam, that Maimonides does believe on a certain level that there are women who can also achieve that. It's obviously going to be unlikely, but on the other hand, it's very few men who reach that level. So I'm saying is that even though there are all these nasty comments about women, and he doesn't, not nasty comments, but just, I mean, something we would take today as nasty, but I think he just takes as being an expression of the period or expression of the situation that he knew it, ultimately, he doesn't deny the possibility of women achieving the same sort of knowledge. It'll probably be more difficult. Just as it's more difficult for non-Jews to reach this level because they don't start out with the Torah. They don't start out with this background in Jewish tradition. So that for women it will be more difficult. For children it will be more difficult, but eventually children will become adults. But if they work at it, then it's also possible even for women. There are much more negative assessments about women in some of the medieval Jewish literature, of course, the Islamic and the Christian literature as well. But I don't think that Maimonides, despite the bad press that he has because of some of the things he said, and because of him, the whole problem of women's study in Judaism, ultimately, on an intellectual level, women have the same opportunity as men.
The first lecture for the afternoon. Invite you all for coffee in the adjacent room and hope that we will all find space. And ask you back here in half an hour at 3:30.